The Volume.
Welcome to the Best of the Colin Cowherd Podcast. Some great guests this week. We're giving you all the highlights, but first, my takes of the week that was. Listen, words matter. Every weekend I get up, I run what they call honeydews. Now, that's a lot friendlier term than errands for my wife. Honeydew this, honeydew that. They're called honeydews. So I'll go for a morning jog, a morning lift, and then I know from maybe 9 to 11, I do honeydews. Words matter. It's softer. It makes me want to help my wife. If she said, go run some errands, wouldn't feel the same way. Why do I bring this up? Words matter. Some people are calling the new system for college athletes payment for the athletes. I would call it compensation. That's the right word. Merriam-Webster's definition of compensation is to make an appropriate and usually counterbalancing payment to. So let's be honest about this. Appropriate compensation for 95% of all college athletes across all sports, football to lacrosse to table tennis, is a scholarship, room and board, travel, marketing. Feels pretty appropriate. Then there's the 5%, the star gymnast who makes the Olympics, the soccer goalie who makes the World Cup, the NBA star, and they keep mentioning he went to Duke or Kansas, or the football star from Alabama or Ohio State. All that free publicity is great for the schools. And forever, everything was under the table. Spencer Rattler, Oklahoma. Do you know how much publicity he gives Oklahoma? Now, you could say, well, Oklahoma's always good. No, John Blake once coached them. They went into the tank and networks took him off TV. The reality is, for any star athlete, male or female, in college sports, they give enormous amounts of free publicity to universities. And it's time for not a payment, but a reasonable compensation. We're all going to be okay. Now, it's not going to change the landscape. Years and years ago, college football was worried that the same teams were dominating. And so back then, an individual school, a USC and Oklahoma, could have 120 players on scholarship. And what big college football programs would do is they would just sign players to keep them away from rivals. So they reduced it to 85 scholarships. Now think about that, 35 fewer players on scholarship. We've never had greater imbalance in college football. Why? Great players want to go to great programs and great coaches. So I think with name, image, likeness, a lot of the small school people or the non-traditional powers think it's an opening. It's really not. Players still want to go play in sold-out stadiums, in the biggest conferences, with the coaches that get them drafted in the first or second round. In 10 years, you're going to see two or three SEC powers, Oklahoma, Texas, USC, and Oregon out west. A Miami, a Florida State, a Clemson in the ACC, and Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Wisconsin will still be rolling. It's not really going to change anything. Like the college football playoff is not really going to change anything. It will get a few more eyes on programs that otherwise wouldn't get it. But college football has been trying for 50 years to make it a more even playing field. And Alabama, Ohio State still dominate. Dear Colin, I want you to know you are the world's greatest sports opinionist. That is awfully kind. But who are the people you turn on when you hear a sports opinion? You know, I'll be honest with you. I don't listen for sports opinion. I've got my own takes. I always have. I listen for format, teasing, your guest list, your advertisers. Can I steal one? In my business, opinions are not something I'm ever short of. But I do look at my competition to see who's getting booked. What are the topics? Who are the advertisers? It's a combative, competitive world. I'm here for it. The truth is, when it comes to content, if I want politics, I tend to go Bill Maher. He makes me laugh. If I want sports, there's a handful of columnists I trust. Bob Kravitz, Indianapolis. If there's a Colts issue, he and Greg Doyle usually come out with a smart answer. I just go to cities, often rely on veteran newspaper guys. They've been around. They're well-connected. They're smartly sourced. That's who I rely on for information. I don't really rely on anybody for a take. There are stories that continue to surface, two the other day, one by Jeremy Fowler at ESPN, that Denver is still very, very interested in Aaron Rodgers and continues to contact the Packers. You know, on a broader scale, something really interesting has been happening here. So Aaron Rodgers told reporters not long ago he liked the opportunity to sort of have the offseason to himself. He's a Packer still, but it's his offseason. And there is this sort of weird stigma like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on, you're not at OTAs and minicamps. But one of the things we've learned during the pandemic is the workplace has changed. We're seeing a major shift in the way employees and their employers relate to each other. You know, for decades, it's been the employers who set the guidelines for the way you and I work, right? We fit into their system, designed by the employer. But these systems, they were mostly cookie cutter, one size fits all approaches that didn't really account for different working styles, different personal responsibilities people may have, different mental states they may have been in, and different needs for the employee. And when the lockdown happened and people started working from home, employees got a chance to say, wait a minute, I'm just as productive. I don't have to drive to work, pay for parking, the stress and anxiety of commuting. Why am I letting my employer dictate everything? My job now fits very nicely into my lifestyle. And suddenly, employers, for the first time in a long time, oh, wait, we don't have all the leverage and control. So in sports, the NFL was sort of the vanguard of the you fit into our style or else mentality. Well, now we finally see quarterbacks with leverage saying, you know, I kind of like to do things my way. Brady leaves Belichick. Russell Wilson makes Pete Carroll lighten up. Matthew Stafford pushes for a trade. Aaron telling the Packers, I think I'll show up in a month. This is what's happening around America, where the pandemic let all of us get off the treadmill and go, wow, there's another way to do this. The NFL and pro leagues no longer have to dictate all terms, just like your employers don't have to dictate all terms. So though I can be critical of Aaron Rodgers, he is now doing what's commonplace for stars. I don't need to go to all these mini camps. I don't need to sit around in the offseason memorizing the playbook. I am the playbook. I am the star. I've got needs too. So this is not just me saddling up to everything pro Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson or Brady. But we have a new way to do things in America, and the pandemic opened a lot of eyes even in the National Football League. All right, he's my guy, Mark Sanchez, USC quarterback, 2007-2008, 2009 first-round pick of the Jets, great broadcaster. And I like talking to Mark about stuff, and I really thought of you this week with name, image, likeness. And, you know, so I've had enough friends that do what you do. They're high-end college athletes, and I'm not a moralist. You listen to me on the air. You know, I was pro-smoking pot 20 years ago. I don't care. I really don't. And I was always understood to me, Mark, that, like, listen, if you're Mark Sanchez, you're a star at Texas, you're going to get $100 handshakes. Nobody really cares. And I look at it now, and I'm like, it's almost absurd. I mean, I think about this. There was a point in America not long ago. In 1989, you could smoke on airplanes. What? It wasn't long ago gay marriage was outlawed. What?
Right.
And literally an hour ago, you couldn't pay a player like Reggie Bush, Mark Sanchez, or Matt Leinart. And I look at it and I think, it's almost embarrassing. Did you ever resent it when you were at USC?
See, you make some incredible points. And I think you have a good perspective on this, but it didn't even cross my mind. And I feel like such a dumbass now, right? Like I saw him selling the jerseys. I saw him, like, you know how much money goes into those Rose Bowl ads. You know how much money the team gets. Like, and I just thought, like, dude, I'm here to ball. I got to get my degree and I want to go play in the NFL. And I love USC, and we get a lot of cool gear. They're paying for my food. They're paying for my school. Sweet. But I also came from, you know, my dad was a firefighter. He made decent money as a fire captain for a while. So we weren't, I wasn't in a lot of economic struggle. I wasn't rich, but I wasn't poor. And I never had to send, I never got a Pell Grant like Ray Maluga, like other guys on our team, and sent that money home. Like these dudes were budgeting before I even knew what a budget was.
Right.
Right. Like I have to budget my, okay, am I putting gas in my car or am I getting groceries? Because do I want to drive guys to the airport when they go home, or do I want to go back home to Orange County, or do I want food for the week? Like when we're off school, when we're spring break or whatever. But like these guys are like, okay, I got to send $500 home, another $200 to my cousin. All right, I got another couple $100 after rent. Like, and they were really doing that in school. And if you think about it now, I mean, these guys can go to the Boosters Golf Club because you know these boosters are pumping money in the program. Now they're going to be able to guarantee recruits like, yo, we got 10 speaking engagements for you. You can probably make $150,000. And show up at the golf club, show up at the restaurant, show up at whatever, do the chalk talk with, I don't, name your sponsor, USC, name your sponsor, Texas, Alabama, Ohio State, Florida. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And the other thing that I thought was silly with all this is that okay, football pays for most everything, right? I've heard you say that. I know that for a fact. That's not like a football is better thing. That's just a fact. But the soccer players and swimmers that like go win gold medals and stuff and can't do a summer camp and advertise about it on Instagram and make $50 a head and get, you know, 100 kids at their camp. That's crazy. That's crazy to me. So the fact that they can do it now, I mean, God bless them. That's awesome. And I left a lot of money on the table. I guess I didn't even think about it.
Well, it's funny because there's three college athletes in my life. Vince Young, Reggie Bush, and Tebow, where there was just something, these are big brand program. I mean, Johnny Manziel's great, but Texas A&M isn't a blip on the screen compared to USC and Texas. So when Reggie Bush was at his height, you were like a red shirt. You were like a red shirt freshman. Tell people how big Reggie was. Just a sense. Because I don't think the rest of the country, we had no NFL in Los Angeles.
No. Yeah. It was, I mean, he couldn't go anywhere. It was like Elvis or something. I'd never seen anything like it. And I mean, people were making money selling shirts that said Bush Liner for president, because that was the year that it was Bush and whoever, Cheney or whatever. And I mean, Reggie got no part of that. Like had no, we all had the shirts. We all thought they were cool. We all bought them for $15 or $10. Like they were cool. But I mean, the guy could have just exploded, especially in LA. It was USC football. There's the Lakers, Kings, Dodgers, whatever. But USC football was a big deal, especially with Pete Carroll and the way he had celebrities in there. Snoop Dogg's at practice. Will Ferrell's on the sidelines. Away NBA teams. I remember Carmelo Anthony was playing for the Nuggets. They come into town and play the Lakers. He's at our game on the sidelines just to come check it out. Just because like that's the place to be. USC is the place to be. Yeah. So, I mean, Reggie would have just raked in some serious money. And this is before social media. This is before, like, Facebook was barely starting. Twitter, nope. Instagram, not even close. TikTok, none of that. I mean, you look at the two gals from Fresno State. I mean, they're doing a full media tour in New York. It's awesome. They got their thing in Times Square and, you know, they do these dances on TikTok. I mean, they're probably going to make $100,000 and split it between them. That's awesome. Like, I mean, it's just, I read something about De'Ara King too. I mean, he's doing a bunch of stuff with like three main companies. He said he wants to sign like a group deal with all of his O-linemen and then they split all the proceeds. Boom. You get everybody to go and talk to a thing. You could set that up so easily now. But Reggie would have been, I mean, just incredible.
The NBA Finals are finally here, and FanDuel Sportsbook has a championship offer you don't want to miss. Because during the finals, new users get 30-1 odds on the Suns or the Bucks to win that game. That means you can win $150 on a $5 bet. With FanDuel Sportsbook, there are more ways to win, and when you do win, getting your money's a layup. You'll get paid in as little as 24 hours. Just sign up with the promo code Colin. That's the key, the promo code Colin, to bet the NBA Finals and get 30-1 odds. That is outrageously good. Exclusively on the FanDuel Sportsbook app. 21 plus and present in Colorado, Indiana, or New Jersey. Must wager in designated offer market. $10 first deposit required. $150 max bonus. See full terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gaming problem? Call 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado. 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. And 1-800-GAMBLER in Jersey. So you're a sports fan, right? That's why you're listening. But if you're considering getting in on the fun of sports gambling, I want to let you know about a great resource, the Action Network. The Action Network is where fans go when they're ready to bet smarter and turn a profit betting on sports. In fact, their free Action Network app, free, recently named the best app in sports betting. With the Action app, you can, one, see the latest picks and articles from the Action Network gambling experts, two, compare odds from different sports books, and three, track every bet you make so you always know how your picks are doing. So if the game means more to you, download the free Action Network app and start betting smarter. Five-star athlete Mark Sanchez comes out today. What would be your top five? Now, I mean, consider the state of USC. Consider the state of Texas. What would be your top five today? And I want you to consider, name, image, likeness too.
Yeah. So name, image, and likeness is a huge recruiting tool for USC. And hopefully they can, that can kind of prop them up a little bit because there is so much available in LA. But you got to go with the big ones. It's Texas, it's Alabama, it's Clemson, it's Ohio State. Those would definitely be some visits for me. Maybe Notre Dame. I tripped to Notre Dame and Ohio State when I was in high school. Trip to Texas. And I mean, those schools are the top ones, but I looked at who's putting out quarterbacks and they happen to be doing it an hour away from my house, right? At USC with Pete Carroll, with Norm Chow, with Steve Sarkisian, Lane Kiffin. So it was right there. Plus, the other big factor for me coming out was, where am I going to be for the rest of my life? Like, if I go get my degree in Baton Rouge, like, am I going to settle down there? Am I going to live in Columbus, Ohio for the rest of my life? I don't know, but I can see myself at least coming home. So if I can stay home and go to a great university near home, and that's where I want to live forever, that might not be a bad gig. So it's a little different coming out of California, but if I'm 18 years old, I mean, USC hasn't been great for a while now.
That's right.
So I would have been real little when, even when I was in the Rose Bowl, when, you know, I would have seen them, I don't know, maybe at 10 years old, watch Sam Darnold win the Rose Bowl. So it's like they weren't like on the map, like, you know, Sports Illustrated cover Matt Leinart catching the reverse pass against Michigan, Carson Palmer first pick overall holding his Bengals jersey. Like, I wouldn't have had that influence for these kids in Orange County now. That's why the DJ Uiagalelei's and who's the kid from
Bryce
Alabama?
Young. Bryce Young.
Yes, Bryce Young. Thank you. From Otter Day. I mean, the fact that both of those guys left the state, that's crazy. I mean, Ed Ogeron said this. I went to go visit them 2 years ago, right before they go bananas and on their big run with Joe Burrow and all that. I went to a team meeting, and Ed Ogeron recruited the heck out of me from USC or to USC, and then he ended up leaving right when I was getting there. But we remained close. We remained cool. He let me walk in. The first thing he did was put his arm around me, and he walked me in his office at LSU, and he handed me some 30-pound dumbbells. And he's got this rack of weights in his office, and he said, "Hey, let's get a little arm work in. Come on, come on now. Hey, don't forget the shoulders now. Don't forget those shoulders." And I'm like, "Oh my God." He said, "Hey, how your daddy doing? Is he still fighting them fires out there? Man, you're tough son of a bitch now." He was just wearing me out. It's like we literally hung up the recruiting phone call, and then I showed up in his office, you know, 15 years later, and nothing changed. And it was awesome. But he and I look back on when SC was USC. And he was just like, "Man, I mean, we used to see other coaches show up in Southern California to recruit players at high schools." Okay. He's like, "This was when the SC interlock on our polo held a lot of weight." Okay. "We would see other coaches show up at high schools, and we would look at them and be like, 'Are you guys on vacation? What are you doing? Like, why are you here? You don't even belong here. Look at this. Look at this SC interlock. Get out of here. Enjoy your time at the montage. Okay. Like, see ya.
It was like that.
That was the way it was. It was a big deal. So
that's the best Orgeron. Seriously, I've heard 20 of them. That is the best one, so easily.
Here's the other thing. I didn't realize that they don't like you doing that impersonation. At least, I don't know if it's Coach Orgeron personally or the school, or it's like, you know, this like Cajun kind of thing or whatever. But I spoke to the team. He like out of nowhere says, I got a quarterback here that I know very well, played in the NFL, blah, blah, blah. He wants to talk to the team. And I was like, I don't want to talk to the team. I wanted to come watch the team. I was in here to talk to the team. And he said, no, come on up, you know. And so I did Coach O's impression in front of the team. And these guys were like, nobody does that, bro. So Burrow kind of said that after, like, oh, yeah, you know, it's not really like that cool. I was like, oops. He's like, you were pretty good, though.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. All right.
All right. Let's bring in my buddy, Nick Wright. We only get him once, twice a month. We love it every time we get him. Phoenix, I said this the other day. They're the Buccaneers. Good young players, all peaking. They've developed them. They just didn't have a guy to cinch it all together. So you bring a Hall of Famer past his prime, who's sort of known as more leader than great athlete, Chris Paul Brady. And a year later, you're like, oh, wow, this is the best team, perhaps easily. Maybe there's the Chiefs, maybe Buffalo. And in the NBA, if AD and LeBron are healthy, maybe. But I do think there's the equivalent team here is that, and it's a cautionary tale on be patient, draft well, develop. And then you don't have to add a lot of pieces to make it work. I mean, you had Ricky Rubio out, Chris Paul in. It's a completely different franchise.
Completely different
Jameis Winston is good enough to start for a lot of teams. He's out, Brady's in. It looks like a completely different franchise. So there are similarities here that I think this is where I say Chris Paul screws up a lot of arguments and a lot of stats. They shouldn't be this good, right?
So that line, I agree with. I think it's a really great comp, and it took you less than 5 minutes to bring up the Super Bowl. So your streak remains intact of torturing me with the Bucks Chiefs Super Bowl. So congrats to you on that. But the last point to me is the most relevant one, which is the stats. And you know, when I first started coming on your show 5 years ago. You know, I was kind of like the stat guy. Like I'd bring up these like LeBron numbers or numbers people hadn't heard and try to tell the story through the numbers. I understand the numbers. I respect the numbers. I appreciate the numbers. And I think they're useful in formulating arguments and opinions. But NBA evaluation, not just in the media, by the way, by some front offices, has become so exclusively about the numbers that I think sometimes you miss the brilliance of an individual player and the things that he does. And Chris Paul is the perfect example of this. And Colin, you've heard me use this comp before, but I'm going to use it again because it's the perfect one and it's instructive. So let's think about Isaiah Thomas, the original Isaiah Thomas. To win championships in the 1980s, in his own conference, he had to go through the Celtics, who had four Hall of Famers, at one point, five Hall of Famers. You had to go through the Bulls, who had Jordan for the almost entirety of the 80s, the entirety of when the Pistons were great. And then they did have Pippen 3 years after Jordan got there. And so you have one of the two greatest players ever, plus Scottie, who's one of the 40 greatest players ever. And of course, they bring in Phil Jackson. And then if you get to the finals, you're probably going to have to go through the Lakers, they have Magic and Kareem and Worthy. Isaiah Thomas, who's a good player, Adrian Dantley for part of the run, Mark Aguirre for part of the run, and Dennis Rodman. Again, all really great, good players. But who's the best of that group? Probably Rodman, who is a specialist, a great defender and a great rebounder, but can't score to save his life. So how did those Pistons win two titles, and arguably were an Isaiah Thomas sprained ankle or just a bad call in game six against Kareem away from winning three in a row. How did he have a winning record in the playoffs against Bird, a winning record in the playoffs against Jordan, and break even with Magic? How? Oh, well, he must have been one of the greatest players ever. Well, go look at his numbers. It's like 17 points a game. So how does it compute? Because he understands what Chris Paul understands, which is, it is my job to get the most out of this team, which means I need to understand what makes DeAndre Ayton tick. I need to, what do I need to do for DeAndre Ayton to make him the best rim protector he can be? What do I need to do for Devin Booker to make him fully engaged for 40 minutes that he's on the court? What do I need to do for Cam Payne to convince him, dude, for 10 minutes a night, you can be me. You can be better. And press all those buttons. And when I've talked to Isaiah, and he was right, because, and I know I'm going on and on, but I think it's worth it.
Oh, please.
Because Isaiah saw that I had referenced when I was initially doing my all-time NBA list that he was lower than he thought he should be. And I was like, man, I was like, it's tough. Like, I appreciate you as a player. I was like, but, you know, never won an MVP. The numbers are what the numbers are. And he said, Nick, you think I couldn't score 35 whenever I wanted to? He goes, that's not what our team needed to win. That is not. And he told me, he goes, look at the playoff games when I knew we needed me to score. He goes, I did. I always could, but it wasn't the best way for us to win. And when you see Chris Paul, who has scored more than 32 points three times in the last three regular seasons, last 3 years, he's done it three times. But he did it to close out the Nuggets, and then he did it to close out the Clippers, and then he did it in his first NBA Finals game ever. And he's also a guy who's going to end his career with no MVPs and with good but not overwhelming counting stats. And it's like, oh, he just understood what it took for his team to win and sacrificed on his own. And by the way, it did it shorter than you. I mean, I've stood next to Chris Paul. I've stood next to Isaiah Thomas. They are both a fraction shorter than I am. I'm barely 6 feet tall. To do that, it's just remarkable. And to me, they are the same, not the same guy, but very similar guys in different eras. And almost the last of the true, true point guard is what we have in CP3.
He's the COO of the Action Network, Chad Millman. So I just talked to Nick Wright. He's playing Phil Hellmuth. I do not play poker. A little blackjack. You apparently have a story that you have thrown money and caution to the wind. What is your gambling story?
So, well, many, many stories. As you know, I'm very involved in the gambling space. But many, many years ago, when I was at ESPN, you were there at the same time. It was like 2010, I think. Because I was deep in the gambling space and I had written the book, The Odds. And so I knew people in Vegas really well. And I had then, when we were at ESPN, started the Gambling Beat, right? I was doing a podcast about it. I was, doing radio shows with you, and I was writing a column about it every day. Included in that, it was mostly sports betting, but I also started to cover a lot of poker. And so I became known as the guy who was covering poker as a story, news-breaking moment event for ESPN. So one day I'm sitting at my desk in New York City at 34th Street at ESPN, the magazine, and I get a call from a guy who represents Phil Ivey, who is by far one of the greatest poker players who's ever lived. In 2010, he was in the middle of this run where he was winning World Series bracelets and tons of cash games, gambling with Jay-Z, gambling with Tiger Woods, gambling with Michael Jordan. So they say to me, look, Phil never does anything, and he doesn't. He's very reclusive. He's going on an around-the-world gambling tour on his private jet for 72 hours that is going to start in Connecticut, and it's going to end in Austria, where at the time he was working with Full Tilt Poker. Online poker was becoming huge at the time, and so he was going to be in a tournament for Full Tilt Poker in Austria. They're like, do you want to go? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go. So I call up our buddies at E60. They send me a camera crew. I'm going there. I'm doing a story for E60. I'm doing a story in the magazine. I meet Phil in Connecticut. We get into the casino in Connecticut, and he goes to a private room, a private cage where they keep all the money. He withdraws $200,000, plays craps at a private table, just him, for about 35 minutes, wins 150 grand. We go have a steak dinner, me, Phil, his buddies. We get on a plane. We fly to Montreal, land in Montreal, sleep at the hotel, get picked up in a limo, go to a new hotel, a new casino, another private room, massive room, another private craps table with his own croupier, and he withdraws $1 million. And he is playing craps. He's got dice. He's got chips all over the table. He's throwing dice everywhere. And when you're playing craps on a casino floor,
yeah,
everything happens in hyperspeed, right? Yeah. It's so noisy. It's so loud. It's the most fun experience in the world. When you're playing craps in a private room with a private croupier and your own private table, you're not doing it for fun. You're doing it because you need the rush of gambling. It is a quiet, intense, unjoyous experience. And at one point, fills up about 750 grand and out of the million that he withdrew. And he looks at me and he goes, "You want to roll?" I'm like, "Okay." So I start rolling, and I don't crap out, but I don't cash him anything. So I don't roll twice on any particular number. So at one point, I've rolled so many times, he's got every number covered. The next roll is either going to be I'm crapping out, or he's making a boatload of money. I roll the dice. I crap out. I cost him $750,000 that was on the table. He looks at me. He looks at me and he goes, "Dude." And remember, he is an incredibly intimidating guy. Like, if you look at old clips of Phil Ivey, it is Phil Ivey giving people stare downs and people like starting to scratch their head because they itch so much by sort of the laser focus of his
eyes. The perspiration that begins on your forehead. Is,
honest to God, Colin, he is the most intimidating person I've ever interviewed in my life. I would sit down across from him and like have nervous laughter because I was afraid. He's so much smarter than everybody, and he doesn't care about like giving you a good anecdote. He's just going to tell you what's on his mind. And sometimes what's on his mind is scary to hear if you're the person asking the questions. He looks at me and he goes, "Dude, you're fucking mush." And that was it. Like, we then flew from there to Amsterdam, longest flight of my life. And by the way, he ended up making another 1.2 million. It's not like he walked away losing money on the day. It was incredibly intimidating, but made for a great story.
And now Dean Karnazes, named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He famously ran 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 consecutive days. On 10 separate occasions, he's run a 200-mile relay race against teams of 12. He has raced and competed on all seven continents twice. And I welcome in perhaps the opposite of Joey Chestnut, Dean Karnazes.
So I want to start with this, Dean, a runner's high. I run 3.5-4 miles at a time. So my high would be more like a one-toke high. Your 200-mile high is different. When you go to a very unique place, you know, mile 88, mile 140, where does it take you psychologically, emotionally?
You know, you become very in the moment. When you're doing these sort of events, they're so commanding. They so own you that there's not a lot of extraneous thought going through your mind. I know a lot of people say, "What do you think about when you run for that long?" At a point, you don't think at all. You just respond. You're in the here and now, in the present moment of time, and you just try to take your next step to the best of your ability.
I can't eat eggs on the day of a race. It's just my body. I can't eat within 2 hours of running. During a race, I would do maybe once in a 13-mile run, water, wouldn't even do Gatorade, not interested in bananas. on a 200 mile race, you'd need meals. I mean, at some point, your body has to be able to handle some level of sugar. It doesn't work for me. If I have food in my body, it weakens me. How big of a meal can you eat on a 200 mile run?
Well, it's funny you should ask that question. I don't think I'll ever live down the story from my first book, which is called Ultramarathon Man, being on that 200 mile run that you refer to, which indeed for others was a 12 person relay team. I was just doing it solo as a team of one. And I was out in the middle of nowhere on this backcountry road. I didn't have any crew around. I completely run out of food, but I had a credit card and a cell phone. So I ordered a pizza delivered to me.
How'd that work out?
Well, I told them not to slice it and to make it with a really thin crust. And then when they delivered it to me, I pulled it out of the box and I just rolled it into this big Italian burrito and just ate it as I ran. And it got all over me. It was a real mess, but it was so good. And I know a lot of listeners are probably thinking, how do you possibly eat a pizza while you're running? You have to remember, this was a 200 mile run. So I was running for nearly 48 hours nonstop. And you can only have so many, you know, energy gels and so many power bars before you crave something more, more substance.
I heard one of your interviews, and I've watched several over the last couple of weeks, that you have a slight genetic advantage. And by the way, Michael Jordan was very springy as an athlete. Lamar Jackson, you know, there's certain athletes, they call them, Dean, twitchy. There are certain people that are twitchy physically. You have a little bit of a genetic edge, and I'd love you to talk about that because I just heard a brief snippet of it, and I thought it was fascinating.
Well, it involves lactic acid and the production of lactic acid. And if you're an athlete, you might be familiar with the phenomena of, say, doing dumbbell curls. And after about 7 or 8 dumbbell curls, you feel your muscles starting to burn and to sting and to start twitching. And that's kind of the accumulation of lactic acid. You know, if you put down the dumbbell and you shake your arm out and you give it a minute or two, you can resume doing more curls. But then eventually you'll hit that same kind of phenomena where the burning and the pain sets in and you can't lift any further. I seem to have an ability not to accumulate lactic acid. So there's, tests they do on treadmills, and they found that, my ability, and we're not talking about a sprint, Colin, just so you're aware. I mean, this is not a 100 meter sprint. This is at longer durations where your heart rate is elevated, but not above 80% of your maximum heart rate. And they just said, theoretically, if you could take in enough calories, you could run forever, which is kind of a scary thought. Yeah.
When did you, talking to other runners, did you sense you had a genetic edge? When were you illuminated on this advantage?
Well, and just to be clear, you would have this advantage over a layperson as well. Every runner has a better improved ability to buffer lactic acid. So it's an adaptation for every runner experiences. I just seem to exacerbate it a bit. And it occurred to me when I was running some races, how I don't sweat that much. And also I never cramp. Like, I don't have muscle cramps. And other people would complain about muscle cramping and they'd have to stop and kind of rub out their muscles. And this never happened to me. And I thought, why don't you experience these things? But part of me was very thankful because cramps look really painful.
Right.
If I don't get them, I'm glad I've got this little ability. Yeah.
When you talked about getting dehydrated in a race, so I've never experienced that. So take me into this. The handful of times you've gotten dehydrated, what is the physical, like, dimensions you deal with, the pain for an elite athlete? You're dehydrated, because I would guess once you're dehydrated, you can't catch up in that race. It's too late. You've gone past a mark that there's no return.
Yeah, it's the death spiral, we call it. And, I'll take you to a race called the Badwater Ultramarathon, which is a 135 mile nonstop foot race across Death Valley in the middle of summer. So temperatures can easily get above 120 and sometimes above 130 degrees. And I've been running the Badwater Ultra Marathon and experienced like heat exhaustion and gotten very nauseous. So, vomited and couldn't keep anything in my stomach, but I just willed myself to continue onward. And I started hallucinating very vividly. I saw, dinosaurs in the distance. There were ghosts on either side of me, running alongside of me. And at a point, I was running and I saw a stick figure between my feet. It looked like a praying mantis, perhaps, running between my feet. And I was staring down at this, this thing, this bug, trying to make sense of it. And it occurred to me that that was me, that I was, I think it was an out-of-body experience, actually, where I was kind of looking down at myself from high above as I was running. And then I blacked out, literally passed out, and was driven to safety.
That wraps it up for the week. We're heading into another big week here at The Volume. Make sure to subscribe and follow us at The Volume Sports on Twitter and Instagram.
The Volume.